We're stating our calendars, 99305, Dan Kim versus Ohio State Elections Commission. Mr. Gormley.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'll try to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. In this case, a man who ran for public office in this state asked you to give him and other candidates the constitutional right to make up facts and spread false statements about their election opponents. As the Ohio and U.S. constitutions, including the federal constitution's First Amendment, have never been interpreted in that way. There is no constitutional right to publish false statements that defame others, and that is true regardless of the speaker's later claims that he did not intend to cause any harm or that he thought people would interpret his words or pictures differently.
You know, the false statement was precisely what?
That the incumbent trustee, Mr. Gonzalez, had accepted an illegal bribe while in office.
So was the car, too.
Yes, Your Honor, it was. That's what the members of the Elections Commission found. They found that.
And what was depicted in the car, too? Just the hand under the table, was there a likeness of the captive trustee in the cartoon?
The cartoon showed the corner of a table and a hand holding money, so a packet of cash, and there appeared to be some movement on either side of the hand with some little carrots indicating
motion. Was there a caricature of the opponent in the cartoon?
No, but the context in which the cartoon appeared was this campaign flyer that's depicted, of course, as an attachment to the brief. And next to this particular cartoon, there's text suggesting that something improper happened at this particular
meeting. And his name included in that depiction also?
Oh, yes. There's not any caption underneath the cartoon, it's true, but no one reading this could doubt that this is referring to both an illegal act and to this incumbent trustee. The entire ad, and certainly the words right next to this cartoon, refer to the incumbent trustee and the text of this question. This question 7 in the campaign flyer certainly suggests that the incumbent trustee was doing something wrong at this meeting.
Was the question, the multiple choice set of questions, the answers to the questions, were they wrong?
No. As the case went from the Elections Commission to the
Congress. So the questions were proper questions and correct answers. Nothing misleading about them.
We agree that the text is true.
Right.
And so we didn't appeal Judge Bethy's conclusion in the Common Pleas Court that the actual words in the flyer were true. Certainly, the incumbent trustee objected to some of those words, but obviously we don't represent him, and the Elections Commission agreed, no, the cartoon is what we find misleading about this ad.
Well, certainly the context of the question is why the people.
Absolutely,
yes. The way that they phrase A and B, it certainly is an implication, even though if you take them literally, they're not correct.
Absolutely. It is just like if someone ran an ad in a campaign against Andrew Duke, it just had a drawing without any context, it might be somewhat unclear, but in the context of this flyer where it's criticizing the incumbent trustee for violating a policy and letting a fairly large, for a township, a fairly large contract, that coupled with the drawing certainly conveyed the message that this trustee had done something illegal, and that's false.
The merits of this case are compelling. If you've ever been through this kind of thing before, as some of us have, I'm more concerned at the moment with 3517155. Is that the statute under which the commission assumes jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor.
The commission gave a public reprimand, and I understand your argument, and I've read it thoroughly, that how can we keep this away from the public, secret, under the table, all this sort of thing. But the statute is very specific. It says the statute, the commission may do only, and it emphasized the word only, of course, in the brief. Commission didn't do just only, did they?
Well, as we see that statute, the only is directing the commission not to double up, that is, not to impose a fine and refer a matter to a prosecutor. Now, certainly the only, or rather the fine provision doesn't apply in our case, in the small statement case, but if you look at the only, it's directing the commission to refer matters to prosecutors or to impose a fine or to find there's no good cause to do those actions.
As a sanction under that statute, couldn't they have given a fine, levied a fine?
No, because they specifically exempt their false statement cases from fines, and that's the result of the PESTRAC decision. I think in the footnote in my reply brief, I talk a little about that, and if you look back at the PESTRAC case, the Sixth Circuit felt that fines could not be imposed under the then-existing Elections Commission statute, and it was thereafter amended, and so they don't impose fines in false statement cases. They only do fines for not filing your reports on time or not keeping accounts properly, those types of things.
So any direct violation that's provable, maybe even admitted, as to false statements in an election, they can only refer to the prosecutor or, in your case, give a public reprimand or something, but they can't fine it all.
That's the way the statute is written now, and no one disputes that. They've not ever tried to impose a fine in these false statement cases.
We know they didn't refer to the prosecutor. We know that the Secretary of State or the proper Board of Elections isn't involved. We know that you say they couldn't impose a fine. I thought really they could under that statute, because B says impose a fine under Section 3517993.
Yeah, but I think it's the D provision.
Yeah, okay.
The D or E says in the false statement cases, no fine.
Okay, so that doesn't work. And A, entering a finding of good cause, has been shown not to impose a fine or not to refer the matter to the prosecutor. That doesn't apply.
Well, actually, that's what they consider to be the reprimand. I grant you, I think it's a little confusing too, but as the Elections Commission...
My problem is it isn't confusing.
Well, as the Elections Commission applies the good cause finding, they view that as different from dismissing the complaint. When they find that the statement is either truthful or there's not clear and convincing evidence on the actual malice standard under the New York Times test, then they do what they call dismiss the complaint. And they've done that in, I think, about 90% of these false statement cases in the past 4 years. So that's what happens most. But the good cause means we think there is a violation, but we find good cause not to refer it to the prosecutor.
Yeah.
And that's explained in their regulation.
Yeah, well, wait, Counselor. Then are you relying on 3517155A for that? For the giving or levying of a public reprimand? Because when you read that, it's that enter a finding that good cause has been shown not to impose a fine. Good cause relates to fine and to prosecutor, does it not? It doesn't relate to public reprimand.
Well, they view good cause as not doing referral to a prosecutor. A separate provision of the same statute wipes the fine option out entirely, and the way they phrase their motions is that they find a violation, but there's good cause not to refer it to a prosecutor. It is frankly a middle ground.
Could they have in this case referred it to the prosecutor?
Oh, sure. They could have done that.
I mean, do you think you're arguing that there's enough substantive material here that this person should be found culpable of this charge and given a public reprimand? Is there enough to have referred to the prosecutor for criminal prosecution?
Oh, I think there's certainly enough to refer it. Would you be able to convince the jury beyond a reasonable doubt? Obviously a higher standard than the clear and convincing standard they apply to their own work. Perhaps that's debatable. I think certainly they could have referred it, though. There's nothing in statute that bars them, and I think on these facts and under the law, they could certainly have done so. 90% of the false statement cases filed with the Elections Commission have resulted in no violation at all, either because the statement was considered true by the commission or they found no clear and convincing evidence of a false statement and actual malice. But this case is one of the exceptions because the hand under the table drawing in this campaign ad conveyed the false message that Mr. McKim had committed bribery while in office. And that statement is false. There's no evidence that Mr. McKim had any indication that Gonzalez had committed bribery while in office, and he certainly acknowledged to the Elections Commission that he understood what the phrase hand under the table means.
Mr. Gormley, the Court of Appeals seemed to reach it the result that it did based on a finding that there needed to be evidence that the individual who published the false statement contemplated that the false statement, you know, that's to me the heart of the dispute between the Court of Appeals and your argument, is the reasonable reader the answer to that, that's the standard, and then the text, I mean the picture itself, the drawing, is then the evidence. Is that the way we work, we would think of that if we were to follow your reasoning?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The U.S. Supreme Court tells us in the Mazan case and the Milkovich case that the reasonable reader test is the proper one. You cannot spread a statement that no one would believe it conveys the message that you're telling us it conveys, and then hide behind that irrational meaning that you attach to the phrase. For instance, I can't publish a statement saying that Justice Cook is a murderer, and then when someone says, but Dave, that's a false statement, I say, well, I just meant she's not a nice person. I didn't mean she killed someone. Well, everyone understands the message I convey. That's the false statement.
The judging of that is from the perspective of the reasonable reader, and it's really beside the point that the individual who publishes it doesn't get it or didn't mean it, or isn't that the way it's to be looked at, or is it?
In fairness to the speaker, if it's a message that is ambiguous.
I realize that. But then the reasonable reader wouldn't. I mean, when you say it's so ambiguous, then you wouldn't have this, you wouldn't meet the standard anyway.
Absolutely. And no reasonable reader looking at this would think that this conveys any message other than what his incumbent took a bribe at that meeting. That's illegal.
So the claim.
He thought so, the commission thought so, Defensley thought so.
But the claim shortcoming that led the Court of Appeals to go where it went. The claim shortcoming, the lack of evidence that the individual who published didn't have, your point is that evidence isn't necessary.
Right. They're mixing up the question of what does the drawing mean with what did he say about his knowledge of the falsehoods. And on that second question, he acknowledges, well, I had no evidence that this man had taken a bribe. That's the actual malice prong. That's what you need to do. You're searching independent review. But the reasonable reader test tells us what it meant, and the speaker can't attach some illogical, irrational meaning to his statement and thereby claim First Amendment protection. Or we could all spread false statements and then say, oh, well, I didn't really mean what everyone sees or hears.
So what you're saying then is that what the reader interprets from the statement, and not what the person who is publishing it knew or intended.
Right. The speaker has to have a subjective knowledge that message is in fact false. So to that extent, the speaker's knowledge is certainly relevant to that, the actual malice standard. But what does it mean? That's the reasonable reader test.
What's the basis for actual malice? That's where I'm having a problem. I don't find that the person who published this drawing did so with actual malice. Why should I? how can I find that there is actual malice?
Well, of course, that phrase is inherently confusing because of
it's inherently important. If you don't, don't prove that you publish something with actual malice, you fail.
Right. And the question, of course, is, was the statement false? Did you know it was false? Or acted reckless disregard as to the falsity?
Okay.
And he has never tried to convince anyone that he thought this trustee committed bribery. There's no evidence that the trustee did so. That's the actual malice. Did he know that was false?
But is a false statement merely a false statement saying something that is false? That's not actual malice.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't follow.
You said that he knew it was false, or should have known it was false. Is that enough to show actual malice?
That's the New York Times versus Sullivan standard, and it's not the notion that we would use malice in common lingo of ill will or hatefulness in speaking. It's falsehood, knowledge of falsehood, and or reckless disregard.
Do you say the mere fact that something's false is a showing of actual malice?
That is the New York Times versus Sullivan standard from that case. So that's exactly what Justice Brennan was referring to. Again, it wasn't a particularly useful phrase because we use malice differently in common expression, but that's what it means. Was the statement false? Did the speaker know it was false, or at least act with reckless disregard when he spread that false statement?
When you say that, that's the question I have. Is the test isn't just malice, is it? Reckless disregard can be the grounds for culpability, can it not?
Absolutely.
So malice,
need not be.
You don't have to have malice to have reckless disregard. I thought that's where the Court of Appeals was. That's why they relied on malice, because they,
right.
and the intent of the person, what he was thinking here because of the malice test. But reckless disregard doesn't require an evil intent, I don't think, does it? Reckless disregard.
It's nothing to do with.
So why aren't you just said that if you didn't prove malice here, that you lose? Why would that be? Why wouldn't you argue?
Well, because under Justice Brennan's test in the 1963 New York Times case, he defined actual malice as knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard as to the truth or falsity. So it's all part of actual malice. And I agree with you. The Court of Appeals in our case focused on the subjective knowledge of falsity of this individual. We think, really, that's not a disputed issue because he never tried to suggest that he had knowledge that this trustee had taken a bribe. So that's the easy part of the analysis in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Gorman.
Thank you.
Mr. McGowan.
Thank you. To that, because it is also suggested then that, well, the cartoon must mean a bribe because the text next to it says bad things about the opponent.
What else could it have meant?
It could have meant text says, Your Honor.
But that they were paying the architect, not by a competitive bid?
That they were, without having open competitive bidding system, handing out money in violation of their own regulations.
Under the table.
Under the table.
Why would that have to be under the table if you're just trying to say, you know, the person here is not following the rule of the law and he's, no bids? Why would you just have money going above the table?
I'm not saying, Justice Moyer, that it was a well chosen cartoon or that my client is the brightest man on the face of the earth when it comes to artwork. What I am suggesting is that it could fairly be interpreted that that's what he meant.
Except if that's the whole test. If it maybe it could, but the reasonable reader, that isn't that our test?
Two times in the applicable statute, the knowledge of the publisher is referred to,
mm-hmm.
not the thought of the reader. It says in the governing statute, no person shall knowingly and with intent to affect the outcome of such campaign
That's different than the drawing, isn't it, Mr. McGowan? That doesn't refer to the drawing. Knowingly published, in other words, somebody didn't put it out for him.
And then the second time knowingly is referred to is post or otherwise disseminated false statement, either knowing the same to be false or
right.
with reckless disregard of whether it's false.
That's all about the falsity.
And my argument is that it is about his knowledge of the falsity. Let me draw an analogy as to where an ambiguity can arise, and you have to look at what the person meant, not what the listener heard. Let's take a simple ordinary word which 40 years ago everyone would have defined one way, and now everyone will define another, the word gay. 40 years ago I say I think my opponent is a gay person. I mean he's married, free-spirited, and happy.
But the
I say today,
a reasonable person today, if you put that phrase in the ad, would certainly interpret it as
precisely. But 20 years ago,
a reasonable person today, looking at a picture under the table, is going to say lie. You show this to 100 people, 99 will say lie. Only one may possibly come close to your client.
There is no direction on the hint. Money is being waived, but it doesn't say whether it's being given or received. And the accompanying text says it's being given. It's being given out to the architect.
And the reasonable person says, that's the problem with your argument. Your client says, oh, but I could. I really need to. Person
looking at this ad can't read your client's mind and can't interpret that from your client's mind and say, oh, but the person that published it probably meant something else. Okay. Just a certain, what my suggestion
is
I suppose that when I look at this and see it, I don't see it as being that strong.
Now, let me ask you this question. Do we ignore this then as only on suggesting that you're
I think that in applying this, the Court of Appeals applied it as a reasonable man test, and their belief was that the cartoon could be taken one of two ways, which is the way that I took it. In addition
well,
to that,
isn't that precisely where the Court of Appeals erred? They're substituting their judgment
right.
for that for the Elections Commission, which is by statute supposed to make these factual determinations.
They just disagreed with
the Elections Commission. Isn't that really what happened here?
They are fundamentally obliged to do that, and they are under an obligation not to defer. And the reason is the language of the U.S. Supreme Court in Bose versus Consumers Union. Judges, as expositors of the Constitution, have a duty to independently decide whether the evidence is sufficient to cross the constitutional bar that protects free speech.
Well, sufficient. There's sufficient evidence here to go either way. I mean, that's your argument, essentially. And the Elections Commission said there's evidence here to clear and convincing to them evidence that this suggests a bribe. And the Court of Appeals says, well, there's evidence here to suggest that it's not a bribe. Now, does the Court of Appeals, is it allowed to say, we disagree with you, where there's evidence both ways?
I don't believe that that's what the Court of Appeals said. I think that what the Court of Appeals said is that of the two interpretations that could be given to this cartoon, there is zero evidence that the speaker of the message intended the bad.
But that's back to Justice Cook's question. It doesn't matter what he intended, maybe, does it? Does it matter what he intended?
I believe that if it were wholly unreasonable, his interpretation or explanation, if there were not two fair interpretations of the cartoon, then that may be true. But if there are two fair interpretations of the cartoon, then his state of mind is critical. But beyond that, I would like to point out that the proposition of law as framed by the appellant in this case is premised on the ability of the Ohio Elections Commission to do more than merely find that Mr. McKim picked a bad cartoon and said a false thing. It's premised on the ability of the Ohio Elections Commission thereafter having made that decision to punish him for it. I didn't choose that language, they did. They now wish to back away from it and say, well, when we say reprimand, that's not really public punishing, that's only publishing. But when they framed their proposition of law, they certainly thought that this reprimand was a punishment and asserted that they had the ability to you don't simply publish what he did wrong and let it drop because of reprimand would be surplusage. You have to reprimand because it's intended as a punishment.
Your argument is now on 3517.155.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and I'm interested in that, but before you do that, I'd like to go back to something that I recognize you say is not in the case, but it sure is in the case as I read it, so maybe it was improper what they did, but I'd have to have you tell me that. That is the other civil suit where your client was found to be culpable of a false publication, and the jury gave, I don't know what it was, $75,000, whatever the amount was. Did you represent him in that case?
No, I did not, Your Honor.
Why should we not take that as a standard, that here was an independent group of people who found that the publication was, in fact, trying to convey that this is a bribe?
Well, for several reasons, Your Honor. One, there was no special interrogatory claiming that specific thing. And two, even Mr. Gonzalez did not find this cartoon to be so clear as it is being now portrayed to be, because Mr. Gonzalez, in his argument to that jury, argued that the cartoon meant that something improper was being done, like a bribe, or a violation of the tax laws, or a violation of the sunshine laws.
Counsel, was any of that in this record?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. There is nothing in this record.
Does it violate our rules for the Attorney General to inject that into this record?
That was my thought, Your Honor, but...
That's why I was giving you a chance to respond to it, because it sure is in there.
I'm not sure that it's in there. I'm sure that it
it's
is
in the brief.
Material that was quoted by the Attorney General.
No, I'm saying it's in the brief. It was meant for us to see and to read and to persuade us.
And in my reply brief, Your Honor, in my responsive brief, Your Honor, I called this Court's attention to the fact that that is in no way part of this
you
record
do.
And ought not to be considered. What should be considered, though, is that the legislature has, by express statutory grant, given the power to punish by reprimand the 13 boards, 2 departments, 2 commissions, this Court, and courts martial. That commission is not one of them. When the Ohio legislature decides that a commission or a department or a board ought to be able to punish by reprimand, it calls it punishment, and it gives that power affirmatively. It did not give it to the Ohio Elections Commission. What it gave the Ohio Election Commission is a menu of 4 choices that it expressly says in the statute are an exclusive set of choices and from which they may choose one and only one. And the one that they chose, they say, implicitly found that there's good reason not to send this for prosecution, which they consider to be implicit in giving a reprimand. I suggest to you that giving the reprimand is a punishment without an opportunity for further protection. The statute is designed to say if it's serious enough that it should be punished, then let it be considered in the full context of criminal law.
Would you be here had they have just said, we find the publisher to have published this with malice, that it was false? He did a bad thing, but our options under the statute, we don't find that we should refer to the prosecutor, and therefore, case dismissed. He's a bad person, but. That would have been an effective public reprimand, wouldn't it have?
Your Honor, if it were phrased in terms of actual malice, it might have that implication, but if they did what the statute says, and simply determined at the hearing whether or not the violation alleged in the complaint had occurred,
mm-hmm.
and said that, and then said, which is one of the things they're obliged to do, to make a decision as to whether it occurred.
Okay, let's say they said that. Let's say that would be their decision. We find the violation as alleged is accurate, that he's culpable for this.
And then they went on to pick from the menu and say, but we find that there's good cause not to refer the matter to the prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we'd be standing here today.
So it would have been a public reprimand to those who were interested to read it. It was just a poor choice of words.
It would have been merely a finding that this panel believed that this thing could have occurred. The imposition of a reprimand, however, just simply looking in the dictionary, is an extreme censure. It is in itself an extreme, the most extreme verbal form of punishment that can be inflicted. It isn't simply a finding that somebody did something wrong. It's a finding that they did something wrong for which they should be sanctioned. And it is contrary of the alternative that's available to them. It is the opposite of saying there's good cause not to pursue the matter further. For these reasons, I suggest to you that the action that was undertaken in this case by the commission was unauthorized by the statute, was inappropriate. I believe that for that reason, if for no other reason, that the decision below stands for the effect of the above stands. But I would further suggest to you that as long as it is fair and reasonable to believe that Mr. McKim could believe the innocent interpretation he gave, as long as you can come to a conclusion other than, well, gee, he must have meant, then he has to have that constitutional protection.
But the courts below, having found that you could not believe the testimony of your client, Judge Betsy found that, and I think the Court of Appeals did likewise. Primarily, it seemed to me that because your client argued that that hand wasn't under the table, you know, it was around the edge, et cetera, they did conclude that his testimony was not credible. They disbelieved him, and that the having done so, doesn't that bear on our judgment of an administrative appeal? Decisions as to...
I cannot believe that.
Even if, and I'm not for saying that's relevant, but doesn't that bear on our decision?
No, I don't believe that it does, and
okay.
I do not believe that it does for this reason. It isn't a question of whether...
We haven't heard the testimony, but the lower courts did, and we have a certain standard of review for an administrative appeal.
The lower courts heard only Mr. McKim's explanation. And they didn't like it. The lower courts heard nobody, including Mr. Gonzalez, testify as to what the cartoon meant. They simply looked at it and drew their own conclusions as to what they thought the cartoon meant. When Mr. Gonzalez, well, I'm not going to go into the record outside of this record, but suffice it to say that even in this case, Mr. Gonzalez didn't say what he thought the cartoon meant. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Formally, you use your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm not sure what Mr. McKim would have had the Elections Commission do. I'm sure we all agree the Commission did find he had violated the false statement statute. No dispute as to that. Were they then to sit there silently and say nothing? Or is he instead saying they must have sent this to the prosecutor? The commission didn't do that.
Or should they have followed? Or should they have followed the statute? What the law says.
The statute allows them to announce that they have found a violation. They go through their procedure. They hear from witnesses as they are allowed to do. At the end, they simply said, "We find there's a violation," and they send a form letter to them. This is page A25, attached to my brief. This says, "We found this violation."
But they also added. "We give you a public reprimand." Didn't they? So they didn't just simply find a violation. They gave a sanction for the violation.
Yes, Your Honor, but I don't see that word somehow magically harms him, and the commission then allows him to go through the process that brings us here today. They could say, we don't view that as any punishment. We think you can't appeal because you've suffered no adverse action under the administrative appeal procedure in 119, but no, they said we want our actions to be reviewed by courts. We're not hiding from them. You did this in a public meeting. We're not ashamed of it. If courts tell us we've done something wrong, so be it. And so they allowed him to go up. So it's not like they punched him in the face and then walked away and said, you can't challenge us. All they did was send him a letter after holding a public meeting in which they found he violated the law. And if the courts then say the First Amendment or the facts don't support what they've done, then the courts can undo it. But here we think the law and the facts amply support what they did and the order they issued.
Counsel, before we sit down, I'd like an explanation for the lengthy discussion of something that's outside the record in the brief that is the civil case.
Your Honor, we simply point that out to show that a reasonable reader interprets this just the way the Elections Commission is.
Right.
I ask you to review
the judge permissible briefing to drag in a pretty scintillating set of facts that aren't in the record.
Your Honor, I think that is relevant to
the judge. Is that permissible under our rules?
I think it is, Your Honor, because this is a published. It's not published, but it's available on Lexis Westlaw. People know about it, and it deals with the same parties and the same fact scenario. We're not asking you to affirm that judgment or to review it, but it simply notes that other people, besides the seven members of the Elections Commission, looked at this drawing and reached the same conclusion. But that's our point, and we think it's permissible to point that out to you.
Thank you, Mr. Berman.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.